Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining in. Tonight's class is generously sponsored by Elise Stern in memory of her mother on the occasion of the yahrzeit site of her mother Helen Chasha Bas Leah, Le'ilui Nishmata. So tonight we're going to discuss Egyptian double agents in question mark. So we're going to discuss two characters, both of whom definitely for some lengthy period of time, worked in connection with either the Mossad or the Shin Bet. But their true allegiance is in question, even decades and decades later. And sometimes multiple countries could claim that their allegiance of these spies was to them, conflicting reports about, who they really were working for. So we'll begin with a man by the name of Rifat Ali Suleiman Al Jamal, a name you never heard of. The second guy, I'm sure most of you will have heard of. But Rifat Ali Suleiman Al Jamal was born in 1927 and died in 1982. He was born in Damietta, Egypt. And early in his life, he was good with languages. He studied French, he studied German, he studied English. He became an Anglophile during World War II, not liking what the Nazis did. But he was also a career criminal. He was a grifter, a cheat, a swindler. He spent some time in the US, in Canada, in Germany, in Libya. He was arrested in Libya by the British authorities for carrying on him four passports, all of them fake. And he, in fact, pretended to be a Jewish guy by the name of David Artson. So he was threatened. He was sent back to Egypt when they figured out who he was, and he was threatened with jail unless he agreed to work for Egyptian intelligence. So rather than going to jail, he worked for Egyptian intelligence, and he learned to be a spy, to put his linguistic talents to work, his sinister character, his ability to easily change identities. He had a natural knack for changing identities. So he was going to be a spy. And in fact, he was going to be a Jewish spy. He learned the nuanced distinction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And he would take on a Jewish identity. His new name would be Jacques or Jack Biton. Biton being a common North African Jewish name. So, according to his backstory, which had to be developed, out of thin air, he was an Ashkenazi born in 1919 to a French Jewish father and an Italian Jewish mother. He moved to the Jewish neighborhood in Alexandria in order to build his cover story. Now, the goal was on the part of the Egyptians to send this guy to Israel, but before he could do that, before he could go to Israel, he had to develop a relationship with the local Jewish community to get accustomed to living among Jews and also possibly spy on the Egyptian Jewish community, which was suspected, correctly so, of engaging in espionage on behalf of Israel against the Egyptian state, aka the Lavon Affair. So, in later years, this guy, Rifat Al Gamal, claimed that during his Egyptian years in 1954, he was part of Unit 131, which participated in the Lavon Affair, which, for those of you who don't remember, was a plot by Israel to use local Egyptian Jews to blow up cinemas and post offices and museums in order to destabilize the Egyptian state under the Free Officer Revolution, in order so that the anticipated Western pullout from Egypt would not happen because the Westerners would not trust the Egyptians, and this would prevent Egypt from waging aggressive war against Israel or falling into the hands of the Soviet camp, whatever it might be. A long, complicated story of the Lavon Affair. The point is, this guy, pretending to be a Jew, claimed he was part of the affair, but that he also played an important role in busting up the whole thing and discovering the plot and revealing it to the Egyptian intelligence services. Okay. Now, Al Jamal went to Israel by way of France at some point We're not exactly sure, in the late 50s or early 60s. And he developed a travel agency on Brenner Street in Tel Aviv. Supposedly, he befriended the elite of Israeli political life. In 1963, he went on one of his many trips back to Germany, where he would meet his Egyptian handlers, and he met a woman there, Waltraud Spelt, a 22-year-old German woman, already had a young child, she was divorced, and he married her. And they had a son. They had a son named Daniel Pitone, who had his bar mitzvah at the Kotel. Daniel Pitone, by the way, is still alive. Daniel Pitone is probably in his early 60s or maybe around 60 years old. I looked him up on LinkedIn this afternoon. He's some software designer living in Weisenbach in Germany. He's a real person, and is the son of this spy. We'll see what happened to him later on, the son. Okay. In the 1970s, Jack Pitone left Israel for Germany, and he died in 1982, still living under the name Jack Pitone, claiming that he was a Jew, an Israeli passport holder, who happened to be an expatriate living in Germany. Now, the Egyptian version of the story is that he was an Egyptian spy who never was uncovered by the Israelis, and that he gave Egypt very important information concerning the 1956 Suez Campaign, the 1967 Six-Day War, that he gave Egypt information in 1973 for Operation Badr about the Bar-Lev line, maps of the Bar-Lev line. So basically, as far as the Egyptians are concerned, this guy was a great spy who fooled the Israelis, snuck all the way to the top of the heap, and got away with it, and gave them a ton of good information that they used well in many wars. Okay, well, that's not what Israel claims. Now, of course, Israel claimed nothing because this guy was a non-story until his story broke after he died. While he was alive, he was just Jacques Piton, as far as the public was concerned, the guy who moved to Israel, moved out of Israel. Nobody was the wiser. However, the Israeli version of the story is, which came out much later, that Jacques Piton was a suspicious character all along, and that his partners in the travel agency business realized something was wrong, because this guy was living the high life and traveling to Europe a lot, despite the fact that the travel agency wasn't making money. So how do you do that? The only way you do that is if some government is paying you, likely some foreign government, because you're spying against the state. So according to the Jewish version of the story, when Biton or Rafat Al Gamal went on one of his trips to Germany, he was caught sort of in the act by Israeli operatives, and upon coming back to Israel, he was told, well, you have two choices. You can either go to jail for a long period of time, or you could work for us. So just like the Egyptians told him a few years earlier, you can go to jail or you can work for us, the Israelis told him you can go to jail or you can work for us. And what happened? So according to the Israeli version of the story, Rifat al-Gamal, or Jack Piton, was deliberately given true information, innocuous information that seemed to have some military value, so that the Egyptians would be under the impression that he was still supplying them with the goods for which he had been sent to Israel by them in the first place, but that at the critical moment he would deliberately be given false information to pass along to the Egyptians to Israel's advantage. And what particular information did he give that supposedly was very beneficial to Israel? So, according to the Israeli version of the story, he told his Egyptian handlers that he had it on high authority from the IDF that the Israeli attack on Egypt in the Six-Day War would be a land assault, and that because the Egyptians were convinced it was going to be a land assault, that's why their air force was caught off guard. And when Israel on June 5th, 1967 began its offensive against Egypt, it began it with 188 or so planes, all but 12 of its 200 aircraft, flying missions over Egypt, destroying the Egyptian Air Force, and effectively winning the war in the first 2 hours of the war. So it is asserted that that deception was aided significantly by Jack Bitton's false story that that he told the Egyptians. And according to Avram Achituv, who of the Shin Bet, who was running the Arab division, he said he spared us a great deal of blood, and using him was the equivalent of the strength of a division. Okay, that's pretty high praise. Now, others writing later on, after the status of Jack Bitton had become a controversial thing, claimed that the operation to confuse the Egyptians about the nature of where Israel would attack was on par with Operation Mincemeat, which led the Nazis to think that the Allies would invade Greece or Sardinia rather than Sicily in 1943. So they're really playing up the role that Jack Bitton, Rifat al-Gamal, played in this whole story. Okay, but like I said, none of this was known to the general public while the guy was alive. What ended up happening was that in 1988, there was an Egyptian television broadcast that declared this guy to be a hero. Now, the name was changed from Rifat al-Gamal to Rifat al-Hagen, but everybody knew who it was and that he was a true hero of the Arab world. Now, why was this program, which involved caricatures of Jews with hooked noses and lusting after money, every anti-Semitic trope in the book was in this documentary or this fictional version about Rifat al-Gamal. Why was it shown on Egyptian TV in 1988? So there are those who would say that the regime of Hosni Mubarak, which was committed to the Israel-Egypt peace accord, meaning the Camp David Accord signed by Sadat, they were committed to the deal and a cold peace. But they were afraid that the other Arab states were getting the impression that Egypt was going soft on the Jews. And so the only way to eliminate that impression was to run virulently and filthy anti-Semitic propaganda on your state television to make it clear that, no, we hate the Jews too. Okay, so this program was intended to give Egypt an anti-Semitic, the Egyptian regime, an anti-Semitic flavor. Okay, well, Israel rejected the claim that al-Jamal passed sensitive information. It was claimed that he befriended David Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir, and he helped the Egyptians in so many ways. And the Israeli administration and the Israeli secret services denied that all this was true. They said baloney. He wasn't a spy for the Egyptians. He began as a spy for the Egyptians, but we turned him successfully. And Isser Harel once said, if they want to believe that he was a hero of their country, and if it makes them happy, let them believe whatever they want. But we know the truth. So the truth, according to the Israeli version, is that he was Operation Yated, or Operation Stake, Yated, like Yated Ne'aman, and that he was working on behalf of Israel, not out of any loyalty to Israel, but just because they had turned him since they caught him and could have jailed him. Okay, so the reason why his story is so fascinating is because of what happened afterward. He died in 1982, but his wife claimed after the story came out in 1988 that she never knew he wasn't Jewish or that he was a Muslim. She was some German shiksa, and she married a guy, Jack Bitton, who claimed to be an Israeli Jew on business, who ran a travel agency, and that he never told her who he really was. They gave it, maybe she converted to Judaism, I don't even know, but they gave it to the bar mitzvah, to the kotel. And she claimed that only after the Egyptian TV broadcast was she aware that he was some sort of an Egyptian hero. Now, she wasn't happy with the TV program because it said that the husband was a spy. And she put forth a different version of her husband's life on the basis of notes that he left behind with his attorney, which may have been consistent with the Israeli version. Now, Al-Jamal, in his memoirs, claimed that he outed Eli Cohen. This is something that nobody knew in Jack Pitone's lifetime, but after he died, it emerged from his notes. He claimed to have outed Eli Cohen. Now, bear in mind, what's the traditional version of the story about how Eli Cohen got caught? The usual version of the story is that Eli Cohen became sloppy and he was sending out too many coded messages too frequently from his apartment in Damascus, and the Syrians used Soviet tracking technology to figure out where the messages were coming from, and Syrian intelligence caught him literally in the act while tapping on the Morse code thing, messages to Israel. But this Jack Pitone character claimed that what happened really was in January of 1965, he was traveling on one of many trips to Germany, and he was in Frankfurt in a train station, and he saw an Arabic language newspaper, and in this newspaper, he saw a photograph of Syrian defense officials standing on the Golan Heights and looking out over the Israeli border. And among the Syrian defense officials was a guy named Kamal Amin al-Tabit, which was the fake name for Eli Cohen. And this guy, Jack Pitone, knew who Eli Cohen was because they were in jail together in 1954 from the Lavon affair. They spent some time in prison together. Now, of course, Pitone got out because he was an Egyptian spy, not really an Egyptian Jew. And Eli Cohen got out because it was determined that he wasn't part of the plot. Because they were familiar with each other, he could recognize the guy's face in a newspaper photo. He informed the Egyptian intelligence, who then informed the Syrian intelligence, who then arrested Eli Cohen. Now, did that really happen? Or did this guy make it up? Who knows and who cares? The point is, at least he claimed it. Whether it's really true, who are we to know? But then, what else emerged about this guy after he died? So, it turned out that his son, Daniel Pitone, who had the bar mitzvah at the Kotel, converted to Islam later in life and said that his mother converted to Islam herself 5 years before she died, and that he made the Hajj, the trip to Mecca, in honor of his father who never got to go. So a really weird situation. Do we really know whether he was spying for Israel or not? The Mossad and the Shin Bet say he was. The Egyptians say he wasn't. It's hard to know the real truth. Now, in 2011, there's a little postscript to the story. What happened was, in 2011, the Shin Bet revealed its version of the story about Operation Yated, that Pitone was really a turned double agent. And they did so in a public lecture. Why? People wanted to know. Israel's not usually in the business of spilling its secrets. Yet granted, this was from a long, long time ago, but still, Israel doesn't typically reveal its secrets. And so some say that the revelations regarding Jack Pitone, Yated, Rifat al-Gamal was done specifically in 2011 because Israel was nervous that the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood government, which took over Egypt after the Arab Spring Revolution had kicked out Hosni Mubarak, there was a real fear that Morsi's regime would violate the Camp David Accords and sever ties between Israel and Egypt. And Israel was trying to sort of throw a bone to the Egyptians by giving them information about the past in the hopes that this relationship diplomatically will not be severed. It's a theory. You can look up some Haaretz articles from 12 years ago that make these kind of claims. Okay, it was a nice little story about Jack Pitone. You never heard of him before. Now let's go to the one you did hear about. All right? The angel. So who's the angel? The source for information before the Yom Kippur War. In prior lectures, when we discussed the Yom Kippur War, I did mention this guy in passing. I'm not going to say his name until I get done through the story, then I'll tell you his name. Okay, so on October 5th, 1973, a Mossad asset, the Angel, otherwise known as Rashash or the Hotel or Bavel, Babylonia, he had different code names, but let's go with Angel, which was the most famous one for public consumption, used the word chemicals in a phone call from Cairo to his handler, Duby, in London. That's not Shlomo Duby for us Anshe Shalom people, but he had a handler named Duby in the Mossad. And The word chemicals was a code word for expect an immediate attack on Israel. So Zvi Zamir, the head of the Mossad, boarded a flight to London, which was no easy flight to get because it was Erev Yom Kippur and the flight was going to land on Yom Kippur. So, flights out of Ben Gurion were few and far between. They met in a safe house. And this safe house, which Israel had been maintaining for a few years now in London, had to have tight security, that this shouldn't be like a setup. And Zvi Malkin, who was one of the guys responsible for the Eichmann capture and a veteran Mossad operative, ran a security team of 10 guys protecting the safe house. Zamir waited all day for the angel on Erev Yom Kippur. And the reason why he had to wait so long was because the angel stopped in Rome on his way from Cairo to London. The reason he stopped in Rome is because, as it turned out, this guy was also working for Italian intelligence. He was selling secrets to a lot of different people. The meeting lasted for 2 hours, and Dubi wrote down every word. Then Dubi paid the angel his customary fee of $100,000 in American dollars in an envelope, in a briefcase. So the informant was paid off and went on his way. Now Zamir, the head of the Mossad in the safe house in London, has to urgently get a message back to Israel using the technology available of 1973, where he couldn't send a WhatsApp message or a signal message. He's going to have to send a telegram of some kind, and an encoded one, so it doesn't get picked up by Arab intelligence agencies. The problem is he couldn't find any encoders to send a message because it was Yom Kippur and everybody was on vacation for Yontif. So he's scrambling to find a way somehow to get this message back to the headquarters and back to Jerusalem. So finally, he was able to send a message, quote, "The company will sign the contract by the end of the day," which was a euphemism for, war is going to break out today. Well, this message was received by Eli Zeira, the head of Amman military intelligence, who rejected Zamir's report. He believed in the conception that Egypt wouldn't go to war unless two things were in place. One, that Soviet fighter jets and bombers had been supplied to Egypt. And secondly, that there was the participation of other Arab nations, which they didn't know to be true, although it turned out Syria was going to be involved. Now, another reason why Zaira doubted the angel was because twice before, the angel had offered predictions or assertions that war was about to break out. And nothing had happened. One of them was in November of 1972. The other was in May of 1973. Now, I'm not old enough to remember this. This is before I was born, but maybe you folks do remember. Some of you remember that there was a potential breakout of war that didn't come to pass in the year before the Yom Kippur War. And the second time this occurred, and Israel did a mobilization of the reserves, it cost Israeli economy $35 million, which was no small change back then in 1973 for a small economy like Israel. So the intelligence services, at least the military intelligence, were reluctant to believe this because, hey, this could be the boy that cried wolf. He keeps saying it's something bad things are going to happen, bad things are going to happen, but nothing's happening. All right. Well, the angel's warning turned out to be true, of course, and it saved the Golan Heights because although Israel did not mobilize all the reserves immediately, that Golda Meir decided, together with Moshe Dayan, to only do a partial mobilization, which, in the end turned out to be a big blunder. At least with regard to the Golan Heights, enough tank units were called up that it just barely was able to, those units were able to hold on to the Golan Heights and not lose to the Syrians. Had there been no call-up, then... Where? They're here? 1 second. All right, folks, 1 second, 1 second. I gotta just pause the class. Don't run away. Don't run away.
Okay, all right. My apologies. That was the fire department knocking on my door. Okay, so where were we? Now, okay, so Zaira, the head of military intelligence, claimed that the angel was actually really not working for Israel, but rather was a double agent whose loyalty was to the Egyptians, and that he gave true information periodically, but otherwise was going to give in the critical moment a monstrous lie. Now, what was this monstrous lie that he was going to give? The answer? Well, there really was none. He told the truth. He in the key moment he revealed that there was going to be an attack, and there was one. However, those who asserted that he gave some false information pointed out that he claimed the attack was going to be at 6 p.m. towards evening time, when in fact the attack was at 2 p.m. And so therefore, oh, it must be that his loyalty was with the Egyptians. Now, did he give other things to Israel over the years? The answer is absolutely yes. A month before the Yom Kippur War, the angel had told the intelligence services of the Italians that there was about to be an attack on an El Al airliner. Now remember that Israel had downed a Libyan airliner by mistake, sort of, in early 1973. And Gaddafi wanted revenge, and he used Fatah for the sake of getting this revenge against Israel. There were five terrorists who were going to shoot a missile at an El Al plane lifting off from Rome's airport. And the angel knew this ahead of time, tipped off the Israelis, who tipped off the Italians, and then everyone was spared. So he was providing good intelligence services over the years. And, it looked like he was the real deal, not a double agent double crossing Israel. Now, who was he? And what's the truth about him? So the answer is he's a man by the name of Ashraf Marwan. Ashraf Marwan was the son-in-law of Gamal Abdul Nasser, the president of Egypt. This was a big shock to the system from the standpoint of the Egyptians to see that a guy who's so close to the leadership was actually messing them over and cavorting with the enemy. But how did this all come to pass? How did it all come to pass? So the answer is that in 1965, Muna Nasser, the third daughter of President Nasser, fell in love with a young man by the name of Ashraf Marwan, who was a 21-year-old student of chemistry at one of the local universities, and they met on the tennis court, the Heliopolis tennis court. It wasn't the best shidduch. Nasser actually didn't want them to get married. Why? He felt that it was sort of a bad relationship. Muna was pretty but dumb. That's what everyone thought. That the older daughter was the smarty one, the A student, and Muna was like the D student. And what was she doing going with a guy who studied chemistry? So, and she was only 17 and he was a little bit older. Nasser didn't like this shidduch, but in the end, he had to agree to it. They got married. And Ashraf Marwan worked for the government for a little while, for the Republican Guards and then the science department of the president's office. But he found that he was bored. He wanted to do something else. So he's asked, can I go to London to study chemistry? And they let him go to London to study chemistry. But while he was in London by himself without his wife, he was enjoying the good life a little too much. And the alcohol, the drugs, the women, everything, it was getting expensive. He was going over his allowance. He needed a sugar daddy or a sugar mommy. He found that he could have a relationship, a romantic relationship with a married Kuwaiti sheikhess, who would give him cash. And then this was found out by Nasser. Nasser told him, you better come home. I want you to divorce my daughter. The daughter refused to accept a divorce, so they stayed married. But the rule was that Marwan could not go back to London to live by himself because he wasn't trustworthy. He could only go every so often to deliver an academic paper or to take his exams in the university. Fine. On one of his trips back to London in 1969, he decided, according to one version of the story, remember there's always multiple versions of the story, to contact the Israeli embassy and offer his services to the state of Israel, that he could access very sensitive information from the Egyptians and hand it for a price over to Israel. He tried calling the first time. They hung up on him. They didn't think it was real. He used his real name, but they rejected him. He called the second time. They rejected him. Finally, they accepted him, and he had to sit down with some intelligence handlers, and he was accepted into the system on a probationary basis. Now, Israel, the Mossad, had to ask some questions of itself. Is this too good to be true? Is this guy really a sting operation that the Egyptians are deliberately sending him to fool us and to entrap us, and he's not going to provide us any real intelligence? He's just going to deceive us. That's one possibility. Or no, this guy's the real deal. It's a dream come true. A source in the highest and most sensitive reaches of the enemy government is now giving us information that we desperately want and need. So how do you know one way or the other? It's hard to tell. First thing that Marwan had to do was, well, the Mossad says, prove yourself. Give us something impressive that only a high-ranking figure could get, a legitimate document that, we otherwise would have no way of knowing about. So he comes back a couple of weeks later with the full minutes of the meeting that Nasser had in Moscow with the Soviet leadership. That's pretty good. Okay, so meetings between Khrushchev, not Khrushchev, between Brezhnev and Nasser, in which Nasser discusses his desire to buy or to receive fighter jets of this or that variety and tanks. That's really juicy information. The Mossad was quite impressed. Now, the problem, of course, is money. Why is Marwan doing this? He wants cash, of course. I mean, the guy was living the high life and couldn't afford it anymore, so he needs money. He's asking for $100,000 per meeting. That the meetings will happen when he says he has something to give of value, and you give him $100,000 American cash. Alternatively, he later claimed that the reason that why he switched sides was ideological, that Egypt had lost the Six-Day War, and Marwan wanted to be on the winning team, that he was disappointed in Egypt's performance and wanted to play for the winners. Alternatively, he was annoyed with his family, that they were always holding him back, and he didn't like his father-in-law, that the father-in-law didn't trust him, and had basically, stunted Marwan's professional growth. Okay. Well, over the next 4 years, Marwan collected $3 million from Israel for various meetings. So there were many, many meetings between Dubi and the handler and Ashraf Marwan. In fact, Marwan only trusted Dubi, and when Dubi had an opportunity to advance himself in the Mossad, his overseers in the Mossad actually held him back from a promotion because they wanted to keep him on the specific job of handling Marwan, with whom he had developed a rapport. Okay. Now, after Nasser died on September 28, 1970, what happened to Ashraf Marwan? He was the son-in-law, and when your daddy or daddy-in-law is the president of an Arab country, like a dictatorship, so you have some protexia, you're important, but when he's gone, are you important anymore? Probably not. Ah, but Marwan took a chance. He put his faith fully in Anwar Sadat. Other figures within the Egyptian hierarchy thought Sadat was a lightweight and wasn't going to last very long. And in fact, there was an attempted coup in 1971 in May, a pro-Soviet coup in which they tried to assassinate Sadat, and Marwan stood by him and helped him survive the assassination attempt. So when you pick the winner, that's good for your career. He was elevated up the Egyptian hierarchy courtesy of being on the right team. Okay. But while working officially in the presidential office for Sadat, Marwan also was selling information to MI6 and the British, to the Italians, and eventually later to the CIA. As I mentioned, he was the hero of the Al Al plot of September of 1973, and had his moment in the sun with the chemicals episode just before the Yom Kippur War. Then in the 1970s, in the mid-70s, he got bored with government activity and went into business. He thought it advisable to leave espionage because he didn't want to get caught, and he was had an inkling that people are starting to know who he is and what he's really doing. So better to get out of the business while you're alive and do something else in life. Instead, he became a billionaire. How about that? A billionaire. And instead of espionage, let's make a whole lot of money.
So he moved to England, and he bought Harrods, and he bought a section of a Chelsea football club, and he bought a lot of real estate empire, and a lot of girlfriends on the side. So he was living the rich life in England for a long, long time. And then we get to when it all comes out in the open. How does the fact of Ashraf Marwan's espionage become known to the general public? And then what happens to him as a result of this information going public? So, starting in 1999, an Israeli academic living in London named Aaron Bregman began researching who this angel character was. He later claimed that many Israeli journalists knew the name of the angel, but that for patriotic reasons, Israeli journalists would self-censor and not tell anybody who wasn't already in the know. But Bregman wanted to find out. Now he knew that Elie Zaira, the head of military intelligence, knew the truth, but figured Zaira wouldn't tell him. But Zaira had written a book, and the book had an editor. And so Bregman figured, let me go to the editor and see if I can, tease out from the editor who the angel's real, what his real identity was. So having pieced together a couple of clues, he asked the editor, was the angel Ashraf Marwan? And the editor sort of like winked and nodded and yes, yeah, it is. Fine. Okay. So then for the next 3 years, Bregman began sending unpublished articles to Marwan, living in London, asking him for comment, historical articles about the Yom Kippur War, in which Bregman takes for granted that Marwan was, in fact, the spy. And Marwan did not respond. It was radio silence. Now, bear in mind, they're both living in London. One is an Israeli expatriate, Israeli academic. The other is an expatriate Egyptian spy slash businessman. And they're not far apart from each other, but Marwan doesn't respond to any of the overtures. So then in 2002, so Bregman writes, publishes a book on the history of Israel and the wars of Israel, in which he says that the angel who revealed things to the state of Israel was known as the son-in-law. Now, having used the expression the son-in-law, Egyptian media quickly turned to Ashraf Marwan and said, "Nu, is he talking about you? Are you the guy?" And Marwan's response was, "It's a stupid detective story." He denied that it was him, that he had anything to do with it. Bregman recognized immediately that that's an admission of guilt. Why? Because in London, if it isn't true, what do? You sue for libel. And there was no threat of suing for libel. Why was there no such threat? Because it wasn't false, because it was true. So, a stupid detective story, but yeah, but it's true. Okay. Now, even still, nobody in a position who really, really knew had yet to confirm it until 2004, when Elie Zaira openly admits that yes, the angel was Ashraf Marwan, but that he was a double agent who was working against Israel. And who lied to us in the key moment, and that's why we lost, we did badly in the war. So now why does Zaira tell this? Because bear in mind that Zaira was the fall guy, whether rightfully so or not. I mean, you could argue rightfully so that he fouled up. He took a lot of the heat and had to resign his military career as a result of the events of the Yom Kippur War. Now, bear in mind, Elie Zaira is still alive. He's 95 years old. His adversary, Zvi Zamir, who was the head of the Mossad, died 2 months ago in January of 2024. So his double shloshim, I think, was yesterday. So we're talking about people, one who was still alive and one who was alive very recently. Zvi Zamir then went bonkers in 2004-5 and said, how could Elie Zaira reveal state secrets? The guy was the head of the Amman, head of military intelligence, and he's now 30 years after the war is over, spilling state secrets? Shame on him. What is he doing? So there was litigation back and forth in the Israeli courts for the next 2 years about whether or not Zaira or Zamir was right. Zamir accused Zaira of revealing state secrets, and Zaira accused Zamir of covering up for a double agent who had double-crossed him. The Israeli courts made a decision in June of 2007, early June 2007, that Zamir was right and that Zaira was wrong. And that basically the conclusion is the angel Ashraf Marwan was working for Israel, was not a double agent that, whose loyalties were to Egypt and that he had injured Israeli interests, but rather was really working for Israel and had given Israel important information. So the problem was, however, that the Israeli courts openly stated that Ashraf Marwan was a spy working for Israel. And the court's decision was leaked on an internet site shortly after its publication. And within 2 weeks of that leak, Ashraf Marwan was dead. Okay, now what happened? So how did Ashraf Marwan die? Well, I mean, he was living in London on the fifth floor of an apartment building, and he fell out the window, and he hit, and he was smacked into to a garden down below and died on contact. No attempt to revive him. He was finished. He was dead right away. Who killed him? Did he jump? Was it a suicide? Was he pushed out? Did the Egyptians kill him? Did the Israelis kill him? Who killed him? Well, we don't really know. All we know is the following, that he had been a little depressed, and was in declining physical health. Only the age of 63, but he was in declining physical health. So there were those who would argue that he might have taken his own life, but that he might have tried to give the appearance that it wasn't a suicide because suicide is disreputable in Islam. However, there's other indications that he didn't want to die, that he was angry with the Israelis for betraying him, for revealing his identity and exposing him to grave danger. His wife said that he started locking the doors and windows and checking every possible lock and security feature, something that in 38 years of marriage he had never done, but that the last few weeks of life he was very nervous that someone was out to get him. Who? He didn't know, but someone was out to get him. There were witnesses who say they saw two swarthy Middle Eastern people looking people by the elevator shortly after they heard him the jump. So we don't know. It's extraordinarily unlikely that Israel killed him, that the Mossad did it. It's much more likely that the Egyptians did it. Now, how did the Egyptians react to all this? So the answer is that even after Bregman and Zeira had revealed that Marwan had been working for the Israelis, he was still officially welcomed as a hero in Egypt. He was not persona non grata. He was regarded as a hero and was seen shaking hands with Hosni Mubarak in 2005. So Ronan Bergman, who wrote the book, Rising Till First, and is considered a strong expert in all things Mossad and Shin Bet and the targeted killings, Bergman thinks that it must be the case that Marwan was a double agent and really working for the Egyptians, or else why would Hosni Mubarak, pal around with the guy if he really was a traitor to the Egyptian cause? However, others would argue, Michael Bar-Zohar argues, no, that doesn't prove anything at all. It may be the Egyptians were so embarrassed by the revelations that that Nasser's son-in-law was spilling the beans to Israel that they chose to not declare him persona non grata just to keep up the appearances that the guy was a tzaddik and an Egyptian hero, but that really they were furious with him, and at the right moment they may have killed him. And in fact, that may be what happened. It could be that the Egyptian intelligence services went to London and pushed the guy off the balcony. We don't really know. Okay. Well, subsequent to his death, what emerged? So Aaron Bregman in 2012 expressed regret in various publications for having exposed Marwan's identity. He said it was a tragic, colossal mistake, that he shouldn't have done it. And in 2016, he wrote the book, The Spy Who Fell to Earth, in which Bregman continues to hold the opinion that Marwan was actually a double agent working for the Egyptians and not really for the Israelis. So he holds out on, he holds to Zaire's point of view, not Zamir's point of view. Well, Bregman basically said, you really shouldn't expose the spy status, espionage status of living people because they might get killed.
and you'll come to regret it. So wait till people are dead before exposing all these kind of secrets. And Bregman also blamed Zamir and Zaira for their petty squabbles, which he said exacerbated the situation and further endangered Ashraf Marwan's life. That's him just passing the buck, because really he was the guilty party. Now, later on in 2018, there was a movie that came out about Ashraf Marwan. It's available on Netflix. If you have Netflix and you like watching these kind of spy movies, I suggest you watch it. The title of the film is Angel. It's not a documentary. It's a fictional account of things, but based upon the true story. And in this movie, the theory of the movie is that Marwan was working for the Egyptians, but in a very specialized kind of way. That he was deliberately the boy who cried wolf, so that at the critical moment, they Bedafka wouldn't listen to him. In other words, by saying there was going to be war in November of 72, in May of 73, and there wasn't, he then ruined his status in the eyes of the Mossad, so that now they wouldn't take him seriously when he says it a third time, and that the State of Israel and the IDF would be caught off guard, and Egypt would have some kind of victory in war. Now, what's the further wrinkle to this theory in the movie is that Marwan was working directly for Anwar Sadat, and Sadat wanted war because Sadat wanted peace. In other words, Sadat wanted to deal with Israel, but he wasn't going to get it by diplomatic means alone, because Israel wasn't interested in diplomacy when it had the upper hand. The only way to engage Israel diplomatically was to deny Israel the military upper hand by going to war and winning a little bit, not a lot, even just a little bit, to change the balance of forces and balance of power so that Israel would be forced into some kind of an arrangement. Now, yesh omrim, there are those who say that Henry Kissinger wanted the very same thing, and that the outcome of the Yom Kippur War was essentially designed by Henry Kissinger to foster eventually the separation of forces, Sinai One, Sinai Two, Camp David, that basically Israel has to get a bloody nose in order for it to be willing to go to the negotiating table. It can't be allowed to lose, okay, because Kissinger at the end of the day was pro-Israel, but so Israel has to win the war but with a bloody nose and then go to negotiating. So this movie claims that Sadat thought along the same lines and used Ashraf Marwan's espionage activities to yield that outcome. Confuse the Israelis to go to war, win a little bit, have a stalemate, and go to peace. Did that really happen? I don't think so. I think that's in the Netflix version of the story, based upon sort of a Kissingerian, realpolitik. What's my view? Was Marwan really working for Israel, or was he a double agent? Who am I to say? I don't know. But important people have gone in both directions. The strongest argument in favor of saying that he was not a double agent, that he really worked for Israel, is simply that in the key moment before war broke out, he revealed the secret. If he really was working for Egypt, he could have said nothing. Could have said nothing. Okay, so that is the story of Rifat al-Jamal, who you never heard of, and Ashraf Marwan, who presumably most of you did hear of previously. Okay, now we go to questions. I will unmute. Okay, you can unmute yourself if you have a question. Anybody? Three, two, one. Alan?
No.
No? Yes? No? Anybody? I guess not. All right, on that note, everybody, we'll see you in 2 weeks. The topic next time will be Israel's reaction to Munich. So we're going to discuss Operation Wrath of God in all of its successes and failures. Much of this course, which has been about clandestine activities, Shin Bet, Mossad, Amman, I've for the most part avoided targeted killings, because if you read Bergman's book, you know all about it. I've tried to do other things like double agents and Eichmann and Yasala, but
We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the targeted killings next time. Okay, see you in 2 weeks.